Alright, panic over. Oh, that's right. Thank you.
There's no projection.
Good evening, everybody. I am very impressed with the turnout tonight. I was invited 2 years ago now, free lockdown, by Rob, and I think he said, please talk about the history of the Bearley Chute. Then Andy phoned me up the other day and said, well, we're looking forward to hearing about the history of Bearley. Not many people know a great lot about the history of Bearley, I don't think, other than the fact that it seems to have changed hands time and time again. And we arrived here in 1958. Now, prior to that, our family had lived in Buckinghamshire since 1620, so we are really newcomers to East Meon, if you look at it like that. Why did we leave Buckinghamshire? Well, I think over the years there's been rather a lot of deputies, and it's taken the heart out of the estate, and the big Robert Adam House had been turned over to maternity hospital in Walworth by my poor old uncle, who was in a wheelchair. 2,300 babies were born there, including Sir Tim Rush, so somebody I actually should be talking about fox hunting if I was sticking to the family tradition. All through the 1800s and 1900s, my predecessors had been masters of the Bicester foxhounds, the old Barclay, the old Berkshire, and they were fanatic foxhound people. They owned the Bicester hounds, they bred them, and they were very, very good at it. That may be one of the reasons why, in the end, they had to sell the estate, but I'm not sure about that. Anyway, my father, when he inherited, started to look round for somewhere to move to, which was quite a big thing to do. He was, 56? He was 54. Suddenly inherited this estate. I have no idea what the financial situation was, but it was pretty well broken up. And he started to look around. And I was taken out of school to see one or two estates. No idea why, because I wouldn't have had a clue at the age of 14 or 15 whether it was a good place or not. Anyway, they eventually arrived at Bearley. And if you look at the particulars for Bearley, which I haven't got yet, in 1958, it was advertised with 26 bedrooms and 2 bathrooms. So that might have been quite a fun that I had. But going back to Bearley, according to the bit of history that Sarah gave me, I think, there was a house at Bearley in 1369. That's quite a long time ago. I don't think it was probably much of a house, but it, as I said, it changed hands for years and years and years until I think Mr. Isles or Eels arrived in the early 19th century, and I think there were 3 generations of Eels there. And they built a decent house. I don't know how much Bearley they built, certainly not all of it, because we know lots were added later, but they probably put it on the map. And I imagine it hasn't got a great history because it didn't ever have a proper house, and that's what makes an estate interesting. And then the Forbes, who some of you know about, they built the almshouses here in East Meon. I think they landscaped the garden and did all that wonderful work in the water garden and all that sort of thing. I think they spent a lot of money. I don't know anything about the Forbes family, but they certainly did a lovely job around here and spent money very nicely. And I've got a couple of little pictures painted by one of the Forbes, Forbes' wife, one of the view of the village church and one of the lodge at the end of the back drive. I don't know why she wanted to do that. None of them are very accurate, but they're quite nice little sketches. And they're not here tonight, so I'm sorry to tell you. And then in I think it was 1898, the sales particulars, and Bailey was described then as all sorts of things, exquisite old well-wooded grounds, pleasant old-fashioned mansion, and all those sort of things. First-class nip shooting, especially for partridges and hares, rabbit warren and rookery. I'm not sure what you did with the rook, but I know you make rook pie, but I'm not sure that's a great delicacy. Rabbit warrens were very important. Every estate had a rabbit warren, which was fenced in because rabbits were extremely good food, and you wanted to make sure you could go out there and catch them and eat them. So Mascombe Valley was the rabbit warren in those days. Anyway, whoever bought it then didn't last for long, and in 1918, Bailey came up again, rather skimpy little sale particulars, but I presume First World War was just about coming to an end, and that's when the Nicholsons got involved. And the Nicholsons had made a fortune out of gin in the 1800s, Mother's Ruin and all that sort of thing. They made their main place at Basingbark up at Privet. They owned all the land between Privet, the 8272. They owned Bordine Farm, which we now own. They owned Bentham's and the other side of the Alton Road. I think they had 5,000 acres, if not a lot more. And some of you, if anybody's a member of the MCC here, there was a time when the MCC wanted to buy Lord's Cricket Ground, the present one, not the previous one, and they were a bit short of money, the MCC, and the Nicholsons lent them the money as a bridging loan, and we now, as an MCC member, have those hideous orange and yellow ties and colours, and those were the Nicholson colours. It's part of the deal that they would have to, the MCC would have to use them. So we can thank the Nicholsons for more than just Lord's Cricket Ground. So they bought this in 1918 as an extra, I suppose, an add-on to Basingbark, and it was the Nicholsons that we eventually bought it off in 1958. I remember Reggie Nicholson and Mrs. I can't remember what she was called, at Bearley when we first arrived. She had her own estate in Hertfordshire. She didn't really like Bearley, apparently. She was very happy at her own home place, and I understand they sort of came down for shoots at Christmas and things like that. And Frank and Belinda would know much more about it than I would. And Ernest, Belinda's father, ran it for them, so he would know all about it, except sadly he's not with us to tell us. But we'll ask questions afterwards. So there we are. We are here with 26 bedrooms and two bathrooms. One of the previous sales particulars said one bathroom, which might have even been more exciting. I think now we have about 14 bedrooms and 10 bathrooms, so things have changed a bit. And the same sewage works at the back, same septic tank, is coping with everything that they need. So they did it properly in those days. Anyway, this little boy of 16 arrives at Bearley. It was quite obvious to my parents or my father before that, growing up, that fox hunting was not going to be my game. And whenever I was allowed to go out and load for my father, I absolutely loved it. And in the garden in Amersham, before we moved here, any starling that flew over was risking a 410 barrel. And I remember shooting my first pigeon in a tree, stationary, bang, with the old hammer gun 410. And it must, I'm sure you're going to be very impressed. I think the first book my father ever bought me was Game Shooting by Robert Churchill, 1957, so I was 15 at the time, and my father obviously realised that this was going to be the way forward. Anyway, we got to Bearley. I didn't know anything about sorting out a chute, but I knew that game had to be fed, and I think we persuaded one or two people on the farm to put some food out. I'm not sure the hoppers had been invented then. And I then had my Christmas shoot when I got back from school. 21st of December, 59, 10 pheasants, 8 hares, 3 rabbits, 2 woodcock, total 23. Abundance of hares, needed another one or two guns, there were only 4 of us. First day of fine weather, and that's how this book goes on. Through the end of the 50s, 60s, big day, there you are, 10 guns, 1960, 28 pheasants. So you can see that there was room for improvement. And I really didn't know, you know, how this improvement was going to be, but in 1965, Ralph and Maureen Baker, he was farm manager, reared 500 pheasants in a little granary outside the back of their house and released them. I think they put them in the wood above Mascom, which we did call the rearing wood until last year. I've renamed it, but
we won't call
controversy in the family. And we put them up on the top of the hill. But for some reason, when the beaters came to drive them, they didn't want to go across the other side of the valley. They were quite happy staying where they were, and they just went back. And I had not learned how you manage pheasants. Pheasants are really rather like us. They like a nice, comfortable place to sleep, which means a nice warm wood with fir trees, and they like somewhere else to go and have their breakfast and their lunch. And that needs to be a nice place too. And we were obviously feeding them and releasing them in the same wood, and they didn't want to leave it. They had no reason to. And that is the whole theory of how you make pheasants work. You release them in one wood, and you feed them up there, and you put your beaters in and drive them back, and they want to go home to where they sleep. It's very simple. Anyway, carried on through the 60s. In 1968, I employed my first gamekeeper, Hammond, who I think was probably a pretty good chap and worked very hard. And the first couple of shoots every season, we shot 70 or 80, even 100 maybe. But by Christmas, it all finished. They disappeared. I mean, we put quite a lot of birds out, more and more, and it didn't work. And by the end of the 60s, I'd fallen out with Hammond because we weren't getting the goods. And I really didn't know what the problem was. The problem was the environment. The trees are barely, the woods, they hadn't been thinned. The Nicholsons refused to have a tree cut, I understand, for 50 years. And which is why the front drive was all wonderful beaches, and they all blew down because they were so close together, and they'd all fought for daylight, and they just died. So the place was an environmental disaster for pheasants. It was awful. Can I have a glass? That would be good. Anyway, I think we'll move by decades. We move on to the 70s, and 1970 was a really, really good beginning for Bearley. The first thing that happened to me was that Ron Patrick, who I'm surprised is not here tonight, and Carol, that Ron, whose father worked at Bearley for years, arrived one morning and said, "Your woods are a mess. I've been working for the electricity board, but I want to come and be your forester, and I want to put the woods right." And I thought, well, this is very good indeed. And then Hammond, the keeper, had left, and I employed a young chap, 21-year-old, called Chris North. And all through the 70s, tree planting went on all over the place. All the woods have been planted, or pretty well all of them, and your little maps there will show you, those of you who've got them. The bits that are outlined in dark green are all absolutely new woods. They were virgin farmlands but by some coincidence they all seem to be on the top of a hill. And there is a reason for that, because obviously we want the birds to get off their roost and go to the top of the hill and then fly back to their roost down below. And I think you'll find there are about 10 new woods on Bearley planted in the 70s and 80s. And of course in those days you had to put a big wire fence all the way around these plantations. Rabbit wire there, deer fencing up here, because you couldn't put thousands of trees without rabbits, which we don't have at the moment, but there were lots of rabbits. We didn't have many hares, but now there are lots of hares. And of course deer are absolutely crucifying young trees. And in the course of the 70s and I suppose the early 80s, Ron and Melvin Dowland, who lots of you know here in the village because he was a great cricketer, he was a forester with Ron, and at one grand moment we actually had a third. So it was a pretty serious tree planting operation going on. And of course with a wire fence round, the woods weren't much good for game because they don't really fly over fences very well. So it was some years, it was the sort of end of the 80s, when these new young plantations started to come on stream. And it was wonderful. And the great moment was when we could get the digger in and dig all these fences out, and suddenly there was a natural, what looked like a natural wood that the game could get into. It could live in there. And it was nice low trees that had nice warm cover. And gradually the shoot transformed. Chris North started off, as I say, as a 21-year-old. He was learning how to do it. And he was learning at the same time as the trees were growing. And Ron was maintaining the trees. And they all have to be trimmed out and thinned. I mean, it's a massive amount of hard physical work. But somehow we did it. And if you drive around Bearley now, these woods look as though they've been there almost forever. And the beaters that are in our party tonight know them a lot more intimately than I do. So that was a great time for Bearley through the 70s and into the 80s. And everything started to really work. In 1984, we let the first day shooting to Nigel Brooks, who is not here tonight, I don't think. He wanted a little day, boys' day, and I think my brother will tell you that we shot 90 birds. And his was the actual first day. And I had a school friend of mine who took 2 days a year for a number of years. But we didn't do any more than that. We just did these 2 days, because Nigel only had the one. And I was then spoiling myself by having 12, 14 private days. The bags were rising, the environment was getting better, and I had a really, really nice shoot at last. And then in the 90s, again, it was time for a change. We got to the stage when I was having more shooting than I needed. It was obviously getting more and more expensive, and we had to make a decision. Did we cut back to one keeper and carry on as a gentleman shoot? Because by then we got student keeper and just do 10 days a year and invite my friends and do the job properly, do it very nicely. Or did we do something else? And in those days, I think there were 3 types of shooting. There was the old-fashioned syndicate, and there aren't many nowadays, but after the war, after all the big places have sort of fallen apart during the war, it was a syndicate that shot. 8 people copped out for the season, met every week or every fortnight, the same people, and I remember shooting with a syndicate in Amersham, and it was interesting. It was sort of, they drew a number, he always gets that number, the best peg of the day, this sort of thing, and syndicates are not the nicest form of shooting, I don't think. The best form, obviously, is the private shooting, but that's only for very rich people. But the third one that came in, and I think it was transformed shooting, was giving people the opportunity to take a day. It might be a syndicate going to a new place. It might be one rich person inviting his friends. It might be a couple of people sharing the day. And there are people in this room who know all about it because they're the people who write the checks, so that's very good. But that, for me, is transform shooting. And if I wanted to go, Lennon Palace is probably not a very good example, but if there's somewhere grand I wanted to go to, I could probably go if I got my checkbook out and found somebody with a contact there. It's absolutely broadened the scope of the whole shooting world, and I think it's been for the good. So that was the 90s. I think it's worth talking about what we're actually trying to provide on a day shoot. I think I know because I've been doing it for a long time. But from the point of view of a person who's spending a lot of money, what are they actually looking for? They're looking for something more than just targets, like the airboarding days when they used to shoot thousands and it was a batu and all they wanted to do was kill the numbers and they didn't mind how they flew. Nowadays, it's moved to quality. So the first thing we're trying to do is provide game that actually flies high, if possible. And living on the South Downs as we do and putting the woods on top of the hills, this gives the opportunity for birds to really show themselves in a wonderful way, and it's very exciting sometimes watching a bird get up, whether you're a beetle watching it get up, or the gun at the other end looking a bit frightened because it might go over him and he might make a fool of himself. That's what you're trying to do, but you're also trying to do it in a very convivial atmosphere. It's a social thing, it's meant to be light-hearted to a certain extent. The hospitality has to be good, and we're very lucky because we've got a nice house, a nice dining room, and people enjoy that. And, of course, now people are staying the night. We started that, in the 80s a bit, in the 90s. Now we have captains of industry coming to shoot. We have all sorts of people, and 12, 14 nights a season, we have a full party. One party every year comes, and 8 guns all bring their wives. We know them well, and we're very lucky. It's great fun having them. And others, we have some of the banking people in London, and they're probably only 8 people, and all they want to do is talk business. And shooting is purely an opportunity to get them together so they can talk, get to know each other. Shooting is just the vehicle that provides the environment to do this. And I remember we had a chap who ran Citibank Europe, and he came to Bearley for 14 years, twice a year, and he always said, he brought super people, he always said, I will never bring anybody you don't like. And if they brought their wives as well, all senior people in the business world that you read about in the financial pages, he said, I can justify bringing my business friends to a shoot more than I can to a yachting day or a golf day or any other corporate way, the day you can think of. He was absolutely convinced that A, they all got to know each other, and B, it was good for his business. So it's quite interesting, and I think people still think that today. But so where are we now? 90s. Partridges. We started doing partridges in 94. I have some Essex friends, and they were actually quite interesting because they're a couple of brothers and they got a contract with the supermarkets to produce big baked potatoes in vast quantities. And to produce a big baked potato, apparently you have to have a ridge about this deep to grow them in. And I remember going to shoot there, and that was frightening enough as it was, because they really knew how to party after a shoot. And they stopped, they started at lunchtime, they stopped at 6 o'clock, and they all sat down, and they didn't get up until midnight. And I soon learned that I'd get on the train at 6:30, and I'd come through London and have a little bit of fish in Bentley's and get the train home and be home by 10:30, and that worked very well indeed. And I wasn't frightened at all. But these huge potato ridges seemed to be wonderful for partridges, and I was invited down there 2 or 3 times, I thought these are really quite fun. And so they encouraged me to do them at the area. And I remember one of them gave me a bag of maize and told me how to plant it. And that was one drive next to Tom's copse. We had this bit of maize and we started putting the partridges out. And for me, partridges have been the greatest asset to lowland shooting in our lifetime. They've transformed shooting, not only partridge days, but mixed days as well. They're the most sporting little bird. They are reasonably easy to manage. And for me, they've really made a difference. Really, really made a difference. Now, what happened? We bought some land gradually. As you know, we started in 58 at Bearley. We managed to buy Bordine in 1965 and the following spring, Garston Farm out here by Eastmere. And I think it was 1980, Riplington came on the stream as well. And then I had this huge bit of luck in 95 to rent the whole of Henwood. And you all know Henwood, I'm sure. I started off leasing a little bit on the side of Henwood by Garston Farm, and then eventually I was able to lease it all. And the great day came when we were able to buy it. And I think Henwood is a wonderful asset. It's the most beautiful woodland. Mm. It's got lovely valleys, which we've cleared out, and all the old wildflowers have come back because it was the parkland for Westbury till the war. And it's a great, great piece of woodland, and we all love it. 99 season, Chris North actually left, and he was trying to leave for a couple of years, and the Duke of Norfolk was very keen for him to go and work at Arundel, and in the end I lost out to the Duke of Norfolk. But anyway, that happened. And of course, things always move in ways that you don't quite know, but Nick came, Nick Cantor, as a lot of you know, and he has turned out to be fantastic. He came in 2000, so he's now in his 12th, what are we talking about, 22nd year. Amazing. So onto the 2000s, as I say, we bought Henwood with a swap. Up in our old family home, we had 900 acres of woodland that had been let to the Forestry Commission on a 999-year lease. So you can imagine, it wasn't very valuable. But they were very keen to have the freehold of it because I suppose they were thinking of log cabins and public right-of-way and all that sort of thing. And it is serious suburbia, so you can understand why they would want it. Anyway, we did a pretty good deal. They allowed us so much for that, and we coughed up the rest and finished up with Henwood. So that was wonderful. And then, one day in 2012, I heard Hall Place was coming on the market. And I managed to get a set of rather skimpy particulars. And I remember going along to the meet at Whitehall, the Hunt meet, because my good friend in Hamilton, I felt, needed to upgrade to a larger house and a few acres of land there. And so I handed this brown envelope to him, said, I think you need to look at it. And he did, and luckily his wife was wildly enthusiastic to be living in Hall Place. And so luckily Michael and Claudia bought Hall Place, which has been a great asset to Billy. Thank you, Michael and Claudia. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
So that produced a new shoot, because we could join Henwood to Hall Place, which is a wonderful bank. And we're now doing Hall Place days, which are five drives, three on Hall Place and two in Henwood. And they're very popular and people love them. So we've got that little extra over there on the boundary, and we're able to really use Henwood properly. We use it for Garston, but we can now use it with Hall Place as well. So that was a little bonus as well. Where have we got to now? So everything appeared to be going wonderfully well. We were doing 30 let days, 12 partridges and 18 mixed pheasants and partridges days. We were having a dozen or 14 teams staying overnight. We had 15 family days for the boys and myself, mostly myself. And we were really making Beerley Shoot work well on every road. And then suddenly in 2016, as you well remember, this hideous court case arrived. And my neighbour decided to take out a criminal private prosecution against me for noise caused by shooting. And I know lots of you supported us, and we're incredibly grateful for the moral support we had and everything else, as well as financial too, because it was a horrendous experience. And that actually went on for probably 3 or 4 years altogether. We think we actually got the verdict in December 2018. Do you think that's right, Don? We worked that out. And one of the main reasons that we won handsomely was because of these books. Now, at the end of every day shooting, I write out the bag and the guns and a description of the day. And we were being accused of increasing the shooting at Beerley over the years and making more noise around Mascombe, using it more often, the drives across the valley. And somehow we had to prove that wasn't the case. And the year before, when the court case was going on, we got Chris Kingham, who always does the clicker, counting the cartridges. We gave him a stopwatch as well and a notebook. And every single drive for that season, he measured the length of time from the first shot to the last. And I think a lot of us were pretty staggered that we think we're standing there for half an hour banging away. But actually, it's very seldom more than 15 minutes. And so we went to court and we had every drive since 1958 pretty well is in these four books. And we were able to prove how often we were shooting these drives, and actually the number of times had reduced because Beerley was being spread all over. And we were able to show the length of time that the actual noise was going on. And the judge took the view that if you took the length of time that we were doing a drive in a season and divided it into all the minutes of the year, it was infinitesimal. It was absolutely nothing, and therefore there was no case to answer. And I think that without the game books there, with all the drives, and luckily they believed that I didn't actually put them together and the month before the court case, they did the job, and that wasn't my reason for keeping them. It's my reason for remembering the day shooting, and I'd rather those of you who shoot at Beerley don't read them, because there might be some rude comments. Anyway, that was a hideous time, but in December 2018, when we got the verdict, we went over the moon, because we'd been back to Portsmouth Crown Court. Some days we got there and it was cancelled. Some days we sat there for hours and they deliberated. Some day, and it went on, the odd day here, the odd day there, the odd day there. It went on for 2 or 3 months. It was not very good for sleeping at night. So that's the end of that. So where are we now? Here we have a super shoot. There is a thing called signature drives, which I think is the most awful expression, but I don't know what a better one is. And shoots are always proud of their signature drives, the names of the drives that people really want to shoot. And some shoots have one signature drive, some have two or three, and we think we've got about 10, in actual fact. 10 really good drives that birds fly well and people are very happy to do. So we're in a great situation now. But we have to think about the future. We have to think about the justification of game shooting, putting birds down, killing them. Some are wounded, obviously, although we have all the dogs in the world to pick them up. And, of course, we all know the animal rights people really don't like what we're doing. And I remember probably back in the 80s, I was asked by the chief executive of BASC, the big shooting organisation, if I would host the chief executive of the RSPCA and see if we could persuade her that what we were doing were producing healthy food, pheasants for living in the wild and all that sort of thing. Anyway, I said, yeah, let's have a go. And this lady had been a member of parliament down in the West Country, and the fox hunting fraternity had actually got her thrown out of parliament. She lost her seat because she was anti-hunting down on Exmoor, well, or Taunton or somewhere, which is not actually a very good thing to be. Anyway, I remember she arrived at Birley and it was sheeting with rain. She arrived with a nice little white welly boots with no waterproofs at all, and Philippa kitted her out with all the stuff. And we went out, and it wasn't very nice day, it was hideous. And we thought, we'll see whether we can persuade her that the life of a pheasant compared with the life of a broiler chicken at Rookham in those two big poultry houses, which I hadn't actually bought by then, we might be able to convince her. And we were standing there, and the rain was pouring down, these lovely pheasants flying off the pylon drive as they do, and we were all shooting away. And of course, every time one was hit, she said, "That wounded, that wounded, that wounded." And we said, "Yes, but the dogs are back in the wind, they'll pick them up." And when the drive was over, I said to her, "Look, here we are, we're shooting these wild birds. They've been out for several months, they're living in the wild. They're perfectly happy with life until that nasty moment. You've got 75,000 broiler chickens in there. Can you really say that this is worse than those?" She said no. She said, "When we stop shooting, we'll get rid of those too." So we learnt the lesson that you cannot win on that argument, anything logically. But I'd hope, obviously, because I've invested a huge amount of time and thought and money into the beard issue, I very much hope that we can justify producing a low cholesterol, healthy bird that anybody can buy. And this winter, we have been letting the Gurkhas, and there are 30,000 that live around Hampshire, left over from when they were welcome to fight for us, and all their families, and they've been collecting 100 pheasants after each shoot, and in the feather, which is what they want, because pheasants came from the ball where they came from, and next season they're going to take even more, and they might even pay for them, apparently, too, which would be very exciting. And Nick told me the other day that so far they've taken 1,000 pigeon that have been shot, because the game dealers are not interested in pigeon because so many have been shot on the rape and everywhere this winter. So that is fantastic. There are people who really appreciate this game, and little tiny pigeons, which I didn't think they'd want to fiddle with, but they've got into those as well. So that's where we are now. As a shoot, I can't think of anywhere else I could plant a wood that would produce a good bird. I don't know whether Tom can or the family. They're very welcome to come up with some suggestions. We have a very good reputation, and of course, I'm sure lots of you read the article in The Field that we had turned into a glossy magazine. And I think we're in a good place. We're fully booked. We don't advertise. We've been very lucky to have people coming word of mouth, and that's how it seems to carry on. And I hope we will be doing this for years to come. That's been my enjoyment for the last 50, 60 years, and I'm sorry I couldn't tell you a lot about Billy. any beaters have got any burning questions to ask me? Oh, there's one.
The argument is lead shot as versus skill.
Oh my God, we're going to start on that one. I frankly believe there is no argument against lead shot. I do not believe we have been spoiling the countryside. I don't believe that other birds are suffering from it, although there was a Cambridge University produced something the other day saying they had. But at the same time, we are being persuaded by lots of people who do understand it, that Steel Shop actually is working. And my good friend Jason Abbott, who is a very well known gunsmith, English guns only, and a very, very good shot, went out one day to shoot some pigeon with Steel Shot, phoned me up afterwards to tell me that, much to his surprise, he seemed to be killing these pigeons just as well with Steel Shot. So I think next season is going to be interesting, because we're being encouraged to use it. The supermarkets say they won't take game with lead shot, but don't forget, supermarkets only take 5% of the game that is actually shot. So you could say they're not big consumers compared with the other 95% that are probably Europe, who are still taking them, and everywhere else. And heaven knows where they do all go.
With well-made London guns, is that, would that affect the steel? Can you use it?
Well, they say that some are fine and some are not, and I don't know. I haven't looked at mine yet, but they're all right. But no, it is a worry, it really is. And it's more of a worry because, A, we doubt we're going to be able to get enough steel shot, and if the lead people decide they're not going to make lead shot, we might find ourselves, you know, in a real muddle. It is a muddle, I'm afraid.
How would the landscape look if you weren't shooting?
If I wasn't shooting, well, anyway.
Particularly you.
Well, I mean, nearly would not be as wooded as you can see from the map. That's straightforward. We're probably not very proud sometimes of our game covers if they are rather intrusive and they don't, you know, they stick out. But I think most of them are probably reasonably out of sight behind woods and things.
I was thinking more of the management of the landscape, which goes hand in hand with the forestry and the pheasants as well.
It does. I mean, we manage our farming.
Exactly.
So hopefully the game don't eat all the rape, which is always a complication. But, I mean, the woodland is maintained for shooting. I would not have employed two foresters to plant trees for my love of trees. I really wouldn't have done. We have the woodlands, and they were fine, and we might have managed them properly, but to produce more woods, which we have done, wouldn't have happened without whether now the incentives to plant more trees do. It's going to be interesting. I mean, up in Scotland, of course, they're planting millions of trees for environmental reasons or all the rest of it, but whether that happens down here, I don't know.
But in a sense, it's symbiotic. It is a positive.
Yeah, it is.
What about duck?
About what? Duck.
Duck.
Well, do you know, we don't shoot ducks as well as we used to. It was quite interesting. I did put the duck flights in the game books years ago, but now we hardly ever seem to have a duck flight. Probably have a couple after Christmas, and that's about all. But there were, was a year when I think we shot, on the three or four ponds, we shot about 100 duck altogether, I think. Well, now I doubt that we shoot 20 will be in the season. I think
that's laziness rather than anything.
I couldn't agree more. It used to be a lovely Sunday evening entertainment at about 4 o'clock to go out and spend half an hour on a pond, shoot half a dozen duck, come in and just about having a glass of whiskey. It worked very well indeed.
Before we had wives, we did a lot more of it.
When do you think you gave up shooting
hare? We did shoot hares in the very early days, but I think once they got scarce, which of course they're not now here, but you probably only have go 2 miles away and you will probably find places that don't have hares. I mean, we, as you know perfectly well, you see them, we've got hundreds and hundreds of hares. And we had the beagles here on Saturday around the back of Bealey. I don't know how much good they did, because a hare gets up everywhere they go and they don't know what to hunt. I mean, it's chaos. But it is wonderful to see them. And I think everybody now understands that if you control the foxes, you have a chance of having hares, because the Game Conservancy did research and they found a certain time of year hare was the main part of foxes' diet. And I mean, if you see a leopard this big, you can catch it yourself. You don't need to be a great big speedy fox to grab it. But why aren't these buzzards and kites picking off all these little leverets? I mean, who saw Sam? You saw Sam the other day.
The first leverets I saw this season was in mid-February.
Yeah.
And I had to get out of my tractor and move them out of the way before I squashed them. But if you watch the mothers, they will go at a kite or a buzzard if they're going towards their leverets. They will punch. I've seen a mother hare punch a kite.
Cool.
And then soon chased off by me as well, so there's no much chance. But the hedges that you planted in the 70s, small plantations, they are rammed with hares, and the kites and buzzards can't get into there.
And the hares have moved into the woods, there's no doubt about it. If you walk through the woods or drive through the woods on a quad bike or something, you see hares, which I'm sure you never used to do. They were purely a grass crop, arable animal, and now they've really got into the woods. No, it's great to see them, and it is sheep management that does it.
What's the raptor population change? Obviously, quite severe, but the rest of the raptors, have you seen significant changes?
I'm not very good on recognising all these wonderful falcons and things. I mean, all we see, frankly, are kites and buzzards in vast quantities. And I'm not going to be controversial about whether they're good for the other birds in the world.
How many pheasants and
partridges
do you put down?
Enough to get them through the season.
Well, what about deer? We see a huge number of deer on the farmland, much more now than we saw 10, 15 years ago. Have you thought about shooting more of the deer?
I think the last 2 years have been a problem because COVID made it very difficult for people to come out. We've had some Belgians who used to come and make a very good job of it. And I used to have a pair of Belgians who used to come over every now and again for a week and really enjoyed it. They're really good at it. But I think it's all gone a bit quiet. We are shooting deer for the pot, because some of our people who stay the night absolutely adore a loin of roe deer or one of them. And it's absolutely delicious food. And we should all eat them venison. It's wonderful food. Absolutely delicious. So, but you're right, we have lots of them. But the problem, it's not a problem now. When we were growing trees, they were a problem. As soon as we took the fences down, they were still barking and all the rest of it. So we kept on top of the deer population. But now, apart from them disturbing game when beaters are coming through, then they're not probably.
And you go back to when you started, were the deer then that you were shooting? Or was that deer population?
Well, we were really controlling deer then. Everybody was.
Yeah.
We had to. But now they're not being controlled as much as they should be.
But back then they were more valuable, weren't they? As meat.
Yeah, they were valuable. Yeah.
Deer,
yeah.
Things,
quite.
They were,
yeah.
It was a valuable.
Then
the deer farm on the other side of Peacefield just started up with some huge deer in it. So it's a good market for commercial deer meat.
Yeah, it's crazy. We have so many wild deer and so many roe deer, and it shouldn't be a need to rear them. It really shouldn't.
But there's the difference between what a supermarket wants, which is the standard red deer carcass, and what the European market used to want, which were much more the roe deer, fallow deer. And a lot of the game dealers are virtually not buying deer, particularly with problems exporting, shall we say.
Yeah, right.
And so there isn't the market for people to then go out to harvest the wild game.
Yeah. I'm sure that's true.
Bill, I was just going to say, around here, people ask about deer control, but there's certainly far more than there ever used to be. The big issue here is we've got a lot of public access. It's not something you just say, oh, let's go and pick up a rifle and go and shoot something. One, it's very, very licensed, very controlled, and of course, with a lot of public access, footpaths, rights of way, it's a very difficult landscape to stalk deer. So, you know, that is a big issue. So, you know, there probably should be less. I'm not advocating bringing back walls or anything like that, where they are in some parts, but I think that is a little bit of a part of the plan.
Yeah, I'm not right.
You give us permissive access to some of your lovely area, but is that a problem? Does that give you a problem when do people misuse the wonderful permissive access you allow us?
It's fine in the summer. We, you know, it's not a problem. Our problem starts in about September, October time, and then we really would like people to stick to a footpath. And funny enough, we've got a forestry chap trying to do something with our dead ash trees over by the 8272, and I went to see him this morning to see how he was getting on, and he wasn't, because he'd broken down. But he said, are people allowed to run their dogs through? And I said, well, no, they're meant to be on a lead. He said, well, there's one lady who always has a dog on a lead, but there's another one who comes over there somewhere, reporting at 14 hours. She was up there the other day, and the dog was down there, and every morning it's the same. You know, so you've got these people who just come out and let their dogs run, and they are a menace, a real menace for a keeper who's trying to keep birds in wood or keep them somewhere quiet, and then there's a dog running wild.
Yeah, but also the wild birds that we're also meant to be encouraging, with skylarks and leverets or anything else that we can see on the ground. It's all very well us putting all these wild bird covers and encouraging them, but if somebody lets their dog go, they've got a hope in hell. And pussycats too, they're not great. You don't want to
So if there are no more questions, it was a good idea getting Bill to come talk about the history and the shooting. We didn't know quite which he was going to focus on, hoping he was going to do both. It's also a real pleasure to see so many people here. I'm just saying thank you very much. This is our biggest audience we've had at the History Group for a number of years, so thank you very much. And David Lohman's telling me that we've got more of the garden club. So certain people like Andy and I are going to dine out now for a while, so thank you all very much for coming. But most of all, thanks to Bill for coming, and give you a fascinating talk. For those of us like myself who don't know much about shooting, I'm delighted to live in an environment where the landscape is suitable for it. It's a real pleasure to live where we do on top of downs, be surrounded by people going out and enjoying it. And it's a joy to see the way the land is used, to see the trees grown there. So I'm just really grateful for Bill coming talking to us tonight about the history, particularly of shooting, but also a little bit about the history of Billy. If you're interested in the history of Billy, there is some more on the East Meon History Group website about the history of Billy over the last couple of years. Michael Blackton particularly did lots of work on it. But actually, there's nothing really about no shooting. I'm hoping we've taped the talk tonight. We'll get that transcribed, we'll put it on the website, so if you want to read what Bill actually had to say, we'll put it on there for posterity. So thank you all very much for coming, and particularly thank you, Bill. Just to finalise it, that other than Mike's trip to the D-Day Museum, and anyone who wants to go to the History Festival, that's it for this season. So next season, we will have a number of speakers. I might have roped in a new speaker for next year's talk about Hall Place. We will discuss that. We hope to have 6 or 7 speakers next year, as we've tried to have this year, probably starting in September. We'll be back in here again. It's going to be on a Monday night. So if you don't hear from Andy or myself by, let's say, something like 1st September, we'll have somehow missed your email, so please contact us if you haven't heard from us by then. And we look forward to seeing you all for the next season, next year.
A big thanks to our bar staff.
Yeah.
Along the back of the dam.